The FDA announced recently it will ban all vaping and related e-cigarette products made by Juul Labs. We look at the repercussions on the health of young people as the Juul brand was blamed for the teenage vaping crisis. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration regulators, they found that the company's data on the toxicity of its products was lacking and it was conflicting. Join in on the era of alternative nicotine products, how you have been affected by vaping, 800-642-1234. Dr. Vivek Balasubramaniam is an associate professor of pediatric pulmonology and sleep medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Balasubramaniam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here this morning.
What do you make of this development that Juul must stop selling and distributing their products?
Well, I think in what I make of this development is that it's a win for children. Juul has been known and has been called out multiple times up to the point where it was fined $40 million because it was directly targeting teens and young children with its products to try to get them addicted to using the products. And so this, I think, really speaks that the government and the FDA have really told Juul that they cannot continue this method of endangering our young people.
I wonder if you regard this as a yes and. Yes, Juul dominated e-cigarettes, was such a dominant player in the marketplace, and it is for now going away, but there's so much more work to do here to protect public health in vaping.
Most definitely. You know, although there are some great statistics that have shown that the incidence of youth vaping has decreased, the biggest question, though, is was the decrease that we've seen most recently from about 29% to about 19% of youth that were surveyed said that they'd used e-cigarette products before. This probably would happen, we think, because of the effects of the pandemic and that they're more of a crackdown on what kids were doing, where they were, how they were getting around. But still, there's a lot of work to do because of these products are really very detrimental to our youth and very to their both their short-term effects and also the long-term effects, of which we just don't know what happens with these products.
There are some e-cigarettes, though, that, of course, remain on the market, including brands that have, like, fruity flavors, Puff Bar, for instance. What concerns you about the flavors and these young people?
The flavors are directly related to young people. I don't know many adults who are going to be looking for bubblegum flavored inhaled products. There is some good data coming out suggesting that in adults, the use of e-cigarettes may be helpful in helping smokers quit smoking. But the big difference with that is the brain of an adult is so different than the brain of a child in terms of how it reacts to nicotine and the addictive properties of it. And I think that coupling the addictive properties of nicotine with these flavors too is really a recipe for getting children addicted to this product.
And I think that you just found that really fine line the FDA is walking. Like, these devices must work and appeal for smoking cessation and have good outcomes there, but not be so appealing that they lure in young people in droves to pick up vaping.
Exactly. I mean, I think one of the messages the FDA is sending is that manufacturers have to feel responsible. They have to have a conscience. They have to think about who they're targeting with their products and how dangerous those products are for those people. They have to be able to think that if we're going to use this product to help adults stop smoking and stop their addiction to cigarettes and nicotine, then we have to target it and we have to make sure that we're only directing it towards that group of people. They can't be just willy-nilly putting out their flavors and direct marketing to children and feel that they can get away with it.
Talking about the future of e-cigarettes and vaping with Dr. Vivek Balasubramaniam, who's a pediatric pulmonologist at UW Health, you can join in with your story, what you see out of your young person. Have they tried vaping? Have you talked with them about e-cigarettes? What was that conversation like? 800-642-1234. So as a pediatric pulmonologist, you saw this firsthand in 2019 that local teen who raised awareness about lung injuries from vaping. You saw it in the intensive care unit, pediatrics. How does vaping affect the body in the short term?
So in the short term, nicotine has an effect that in the brain, it releases dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's involved in a high if you have it. Other addictive compounds such as opioids and other things also stimulate the brain to release dopamine. Dopamine's effects give you that high, but the difference between nicotine and other opioids is that the other opioids last for a long period of time, whereas nicotine goes away within minutes of you stopping to inhale it or stopping to use it. And therefore, you get a quick withdrawal from that high. And so you want to use it again and again. And this is how, you know, nicotine has been addictive for the use in regular cigarettes and also is in e-cigarettes. The other thing that e-cigarettes do is the concentration or the dose of nicotine that someone is getting using an e-cigarette is much higher than a traditional cigarette. And that in that regard, the dose is higher, the addictive properties are much higher, and people use it much more quickly and get addicted to it. The other thing is that, you know, the effects of nicotine on adolescents and adults is different. In adults, the side effects of nicotine acutely, if you have it, it decreases your activity, your motor activity, your function is not as good, your coordination is not as good, whereas in adolescents, it enhances this. In adults, adults are more sensitive to the adverse effects of nicotine, whereas adolescent brains, because the wiring is still being developed, are actually more sensitive to the rewarding effects of nicotine. When you have a withdrawal symptom from nicotine in adults, because of the wiring of an adult brain being different, they display severe withdrawal symptoms, whereas in adolescents, the symptoms that they're of withdrawal that they have are blunted. So there's not an adverse effect to that. And then when you get high doses of nicotine, actually in adults, getting a high dose of nicotine makes adults feel sick, makes them not feel good, whereas in adolescents, it's more well tolerated. And this lowers kind of the aversion to higher doses as they get older. And finally, you know, the biggest thing is that nicotine, when it's used, it doesn't, in adults, it doesn't have any effects on like psychostimulants or alcohol or any other drugs that you could use. Whereas in children and in adolescents, it enhances their acquisition of the use of other drugs, which is really a worrisome thing for a pediatrician and a pediatric pulmonologist like myself.
When you talk with your young patients about vaping or you treat these young patients for vaping-related injuries, do they continue to use e-cigarettes?
Yes and no. I think that nicotine is such an addictive substance that it's really hard for them to stop using it. Mm. The other thing also is the social situations that they're in also push them to use it. I have frank and honest conversations with these youth, telling them that one, you know, they're addicted to a compound that, and also two, that a company is specifically targeting them to get their money. And do they want to be targeted? Do they want to be taken advantage of? And that approach seems to resonate with the youth of today, that no, they don't want to be taken advantage of by large companies. And then the key thing, though, that we have to do when we have children that are addicted to it is give them a plan to wean them off the nicotine. So slowly come down in a way that helps them break that cycle of addictive behavior from using nicotine.
UW School of Medicine and Public Health pediatric pulmonologist Vivek Balasubramaniam stays with us on teen vaping and federal regulators, the work to contain vaping products, illnesses caused by inhalable products containing highly addictive nicotine. Join in with your story about vaping, your questions, what you want to know about the FDA's findings, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing teen vaping, the ban of Juul e-cigarettes in the U.S., implications on public health. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The FDA says e-cigarettes are the most commonly used tobacco product among youth. Prevention campaigns have been underway for years. The American Lung Association worked with the Ad Council to do this one, which shows parents with their heads literally in a cloud of smoke.
No way.
No way.
No way. No way. My kid would never vape.
Get your head out of the cloud. Today, nearly 8,000 kids will start vaping. Maybe even yours.
Join in on your questions about e-cigarettes, where we go from here, 800-642-1234. Dr. Vivek Balasubramaniam is an associate professor of pediatric pulmonology and sleep medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health with us for about 9 more minutes. So you were mentioning there how your patients gradually get off e-cigarettes. How do you gradually taper or wean a young person off vaping?
So there are, you know, proven approaches in adults to utilize other nicotine products that like nicotine patches, nicotine gum. There are some other medications that help you break that addictive cycle. And so what we have been doing is been using a combination of those to help these kids get off their nicotine. And it actually does help. The patients that I have taken care of, and from talking to colleagues around the country, this is an approach that really does work, that giving them these type of products to use, slowly coming down on the dose of nicotine that these kids have, and then also, most importantly, instituting some cognitive behavioral therapy that tells them why they're addicted, what situations contributed to their addiction themselves, and also continue to educate them on the dangers of these products and how severe an injury they can have or have already sustained because of these products.
Were you able to follow the youth who had been in pediatric intensive care because of extreme vaping and what their lung capacity was, you know, in subsequent years now?
So that there has been some studies that have been looking at the long-term effects of vaping on children. Acutely, there is definitely a decrease in their lung function. They're very much short of breath. They have a hard time walking around, doing normal activities. That slowly improves over time. It takes over a couple of months though, but their lung function does start to improve. And because kids are much more physically resilient than adults, they are able to come back up to a point where they can function normally. But some studies now are showing that there are long-term effects in terms of a slight decrease in lung function in these kids, and also a slight decrease in their ability to take up oxygen and also in exercise. And I think the most worrisome thing about it is our lungs grow when we're children. They start growth right after we're born, actually even in utero, and they continue on throughout childhood and into adolescence. We peak at our lung function at somewhere between about 18 to 22 years of age. That's where we get the highest. And then after that, you have a slow decline in your lung function throughout the rest of your life. If there's anything that affects that ability to get as high as you can in your lung function because you sustain an injury or something else during adolescence, that puts you already at a disadvantage in terms of how long you're going to be able to last in terms of your lung function as you get older. And we don't know what the implications are in terms of what types of lung diseases and other things these children are going to have when they're in their, you know, 50s and 60s, and what the effects of those are.
The FDA also, in its statement, was really concerned about the leakage from cartridges and the toxicity concerns. Not sure what chemicals were actually leaching out of these products. What concerns do you have there?
So two concerns really I worry about is that, as opposed to regular cigarette smoke, the e-cigarettes aerosolize that e-juice, the nicotine-containing juice, into very, very small particles. And these particles are associated with things like formaldehyde, toluenes, nitrosamines. These are all toxic agents that are cancer-causing as well. In addition, there are heavy metals such as cadmium, nickel, lead, other things that get deep within the lung, much deeper than you would get with regular cigarette smoke or regular smoke itself. And these small particulate matters that as deeper as they get, they can cause more of that lung injury in a place that we haven't seen, we don't have experience from clinically, because in terms of comparing it to just to regular cigarette smoke. So we really don't know what that deep lung injury does, but if you kind of correlate that to a type of an inhalational injury that we'd see with other products, it's pretty toxic. And it causes some damage to the small air sacs in your lungs that you may not be able to recover from. And that's the, I think, the thing that is worrisome about what is in these products is not only the size of the particles, but also how deep they get, but also what is in them and getting deep into the lungs.
Talking about the dangers of e-cigarettes and vaping, the future of regulation from the FDA with Dr. Vivek Bala Subramaniam, pediatric pulmonologist at UW Health. Still time for your questions about e-cigarettes. What has occurred in your household? 800-642-1234. The FDA also announced plans earlier this year to reduce nicotine levels in traditional cigarettes. That news came out, I think, in the spring, and it said it would move toward a ban on menthol-flavored cigarettes. What will those steps mean for younger people, younger patients?
I think it's a great thing in terms of regular cigarettes. If you can decrease the nicotine concentrations, again, you're going to decrease the drive to become addicted to it. The menthols are a thing that
menthol has been that conflict zone now for years.
It has been totally a conflict zone. It's been implicated or thought or discussed that menthols may be targeting certain populations, such as African Americans and other populations, to use cigarettes. It's really been a very nasty little fight going on in terms of keeping the menthol on. The purpose of having menthol is to make it so that the cigarette smoke doesn't burn as much when you inhale it, which is just really kind of strange to think about, that you have a product that burns and you add something to it that reduces that burn. Well, isn't it bad to inhale something that burns your throat and your lungs? So I think that what the steps that the FDA is making in terms of regular cigarettes is great. And I think that they need to continue down that track and institute those also in e-cigarettes and started controlling the amount of nicotine that's in e-cigarettes and bringing it down so it's not so addictive.
You alluded to this earlier. It's really hard to break through the peer pressure, the students seeing other young people vaping and the pressures of that. We've seen all of these ad campaigns trying to target youth about the dangers. Are they making an impact?
I think they are. I mean, I think that although, you know, the statistics that I quoted earlier about a decrease in self-reported use of e-cigarettes in teens in 2021 compared to the last survey that was done in 2019, maybe due to the effects of the pandemic. But we also hope that there was a component of that was due to the public health approach of educating these kids about what the dangers are, educating them to how it's going to impact them. And you know, I have two teenage sons. I have a lot of confidence in the youth of America and that they are pretty smart, and that when they're presented with the information, with the knowledge, that they will actually hear that and also then utilize that information to make their lives better and to protect them, to keep them growing and keep them developing so they have full lives ahead of them.
There's also the lobbyists and the courts. You know, this will be litigated. The head of the American Vapor Manufacturers Association called out the FDA for people's right to switch to the vastly safer alternative of vaping that will surely rank as one of the greatest episodes of regulatory malpractice in American history. So they make no bones about it that it is a person's choice to switch over to vaping, and vaping is safer. How will the lobbyists, take this to the next stage of trying to get around the regulations?
Well, I mean, firstly, you know, the FDA did not outlaw all vaping products. There are vaping products out there, and if they are being utilized in a positive manner to help people quit smoking, that's great, that they should be utilized in that regard. I think that the lobbyists, if they'll try to keep away from talking about the effects of vaping on children and on adolescents and the long-term effects that this is going to have on the youth of America. And I think that's where the focus needs really to be, is to say, yes, there is a use for this product. Yes, it is a product that can help people get off smoking when they're adults. But we really need to regulate the product to make, because it's so highly available to children, that we have to make sure that children can't get a hold of it and they can't get the toxic effects that we're seeing clinically from these products.
Dr. Balasubramaniam, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Dr. Vivek Balasubramaniam is an associate professor of pediatric pulmonology and sleep medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Ahead this hour, we talk with a Mayo Clinic physician about COVID long haulers and gastrointestinal complications. Join in on COVID and digestive problems, 800-642-1234. News is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a food tradition involving fish.
People have been fishing the Mississippi River for about 1,000 years. It's a tradition that's passed down through families for survival and recreation. Mike Valley is part of that tradition and one of the last people to still make a living as a commercial fisherman on the upper Mississippi. And when he gets his catch, he often smokes it. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy hopped on Valley's boat to learn more about his smoked fish and his love of the river.
There are few fishermen like Mike Valley left on the Mississippi River.
The millions of pounds of fish that I've caught, it's still peace and tranquility for me out here. It is a lost art. It's a dying art. Like sitting here right now, I mean, this is just absolutely beautiful to me. To get out of that phone ringing, people knocking all day, every day, it's just like, ah.
Valley is a third-generation fisherman. The work is in his blood. He's owned Valley Fish and Cheese in Prairie du Chien since the 1980s. He grew up hunting, trapping, clamming, and working with his father. His dad also had a shop on the river and sold his fish to markets in Chicago, New York, and Boston. But as the fishing industry changed, Valley knew the only way he was going to survive was by forging his own path. Sell quality, fresh fish and products that you can't find anywhere else.
I have always said, you'll never have anyone come into my shop and then leave and then go home and tell all their friends and their relatives, this guy had beef jerky, or oh my God, he had Colby cheese. No, he had snapping turtle jerky, he had alligator jerky, catfish bologna, the weird things.
Valley is particular. Years of fishing and smoking his catch have taught him that you can't cut corners if you want to stand out. Even though he's caught millions of pounds of fish, the novelty hasn't worn off.
I still really, truly enjoy catching fish. The cleaning, not so much. But that's part of the job. Everybody that I take with me always, they're like, oh my God, this is so fun. This is really great. And then you get back and they go, see ya. So.
Valley cleans the fish, typically catfish, carp, buffalo, and sturgeon, up to 4 times. Then he brines it for at least half a day. Details matter. Not all fish are the same, and they shouldn't be treated the same, he says. The thicker the fish, the more salt you're going to need. And each fish gets its own brine with different seasonings that bring out its flavors. Then Valley puts the fish in the smoker, which he claims is the only licensed 100% wood smoker left in the state.
We light it with wood, it ends with wood. No liquid smoke, no gas, no nothing. And that is huge. It makes a world of difference. Basically, we're all hickory. Once in a while, we'll burn a little apple wood.
And it can't be rushed. Patience is key. Valley could finish the fish in an hour, but he prefers to give it 10 to 12 hours to really soak up the smoky flavor.
I relate it to a sponge. If you just barely hold it on the water, just missed it, it sucks it in and it takes time. So that's what you want to do with the fish. You want to very slowly permeate it and bring it up to temp. You know, otherwise if you just cook it, it's just a cooked piece of fish. It isn't smoked.
1734.
Valley jokes about a law he has at Valley Fish and Cheese when customers make a modest purchase. Once you buy it and leave the door, you can't come back in and buy more.
I will literally, honestly, hear 10 times a day, this is unbelievable smoked fish. Well, it is. Because it was swimming yesterday and it's smoked today. It's to die for.
Yet all that being said, Valley says you don't necessarily need to head over to the Mississippi and catch the fish yourself. He recommends finding a nice piece of salmon or fish of your choice and practicing a little patience.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Mike Valley's smoked fish. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now to long-term gastrointestinal problems associated with COVID here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Harvard researchers told The Guardian recently that there could be reservoirs of COVID hiding out in the gut microbiome, and that could be contributing to long COVID and have implications on the immune system. Join in on digestive symptoms and gut health with COVID, 800-642-1234. Dr. Greg Vanishkashorn is director of Mayo Clinic's COVID Activity Rehabilitation Program in Rochester, Minnesota, helping patients struggling with post-COVID syndrome and work-related issues. Dr. Vanishkashorn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me today. It's my pleasure.
You're in touch with a whole lot of COVID long haulers. How common are digestive problems?
Well, unfortunately, this is a symptom that we are hearing more about lately. Current research shows that almost 16% of patients who have a COVID infection can have some new ongoing GI symptoms afterwards for several months. I think we're only starting to hear about this now because it doesn't seem to be a symptom that people think about on the top of their head when they consider a respiratory illness like COVID.
Let's pick apart new ongoing. Generally speaking, have these COVID patients experienced the GI symptoms at the onset of COVID, or have these issues presented weeks later?
Most of the patients will have some form of GI symptom during the acute illness. You know, we get a little bit nauseous or maybe a little bit of diarrhea every time we have some sort of viral illness. But unfortunately, these just don't seem to go away. Now, that's the majority of cases, but there are also some individuals who have a little bit of a gap between their acute COVID infection. Things seem to get better, but then things get a lot worse afterwards.
How does COVID get into the GI tract anyway? Can you kind of, walk us through what's going on in the organs?
Yeah. So there are these receptors called the ACE receptors. And it's the way that the COVID virus enters into our cells. And this receptor is kind of all over the body. But in a few areas, we see this a whole lot, the receptor. One is in the lungs, that makes sense, but also in the GI tract. So there definitely is the ability for the virus to directly invade the cells that line our GI system. But it's not just the virus that we worry about itself. There's also that inflammation problem that comes with the acute infection. And that can affect the body all over. And the GI system is particularly sensitive to that kind of inflammation. So, you know, is it the virus or is it the inflammation that's causing the GI problems? We're not quite sure yet.
You mentioned inflammation, and I'm thinking about this gastroenterologist at Cedars-Sinai last week said there's been this nationwide uptick in irritable bowel syndrome, like seeing cases where people are left with IBS long after COVID seems to have disappeared. Is there research going on there? Can a COVID infection lead to IBS?
I think this is definitely possible. The symptoms that we see with the GI complaints following a COVID infection, they're very similar to irritable bowel syndrome. So things like abdominal pain, constipation, diarrhea, bloating, those kinds of things. They're right up there. Now, it remains to be determined right now, is this irritable bowel that's being caused by long COVID, or is this something that's distinct and just COVID related? We don't have the answers yet. We are doing a lot of research here at Mayo, but you know, there's just a lot of things to be done first.
Are some people more susceptible to GI symptoms in COVID than others? Is there a particular demographic?
Great question. We've been looking at risk factors for quite a bit to see if there's any predisposition to these GI symptoms. And so far, we haven't found a pattern. It really does seem like anybody can come down with these symptoms after COVID.
And, you know, when we think about COVID, we think of the respiratory issues, the coughing, the sore throat, the lung issues. And I'm just thinking about my young kids coming home from camp and complaining of a stomach bug. And before COVID, you know, I never would have thought twice. It's, oh, you know, it too will pass as a stomach bug, and them being tethered to the bathroom. Should I do a COVID rapid test in these circumstances?
Absolutely. I think what we have come to realize is that the acute COVID infection, especially with some of the more recent variants like Omicron, they can cause some really subtle symptoms. You may not get the full-on cough and fever and so forth, but maybe a little bit of fatigue or some GI symptoms. And so if there's been an exposure and there's some new symptoms, I recommend testing.
Long COVID has also been associated with depression and anxiety. How do researchers know the GI symptoms are related to COVID rather than a secondary symptom like something, a mental health or anxiety issue?
The million-dollar question there. Unfortunately, right now, we don't have a diagnostic test that can help determine if someone is suffering primarily long COVID or something else that's related to the COVID infection, such as depression and anxiety. I mean, this can happen to anybody that suffers a crucial illness. So right now, that's still a question that we're trying to solve. But the important thing to remember is that no matter what, if someone is suffering symptoms like that, GI symptoms, depression and anxiety, the treatment is going to be the same, whether it's with long COVID or without.
Dr. Greg Vanishkashorn leads Mayo Clinic's COVID Activity Rehabilitation Program on working to treat long COVID patients with symptoms lasting weeks, months. Join in on COVID, digestive problems, long COVID, other long-term effects like fatigue, abdominal pain, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation at the intersection of long COVID symptoms and gut health. The CDC defines long COVID as ongoing or new health problems that occur at least 4 weeks after a COVID infection. Scientists are working on a lot of questions about the condition. We're exploring persistent GI tract symptoms and issues. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Dr. Greg Vanishkashorn is director of Mayo Clinic's COVID Activity Rehabilitation Program in Minnesota with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Jenny is joining us from Green Bay. Jenny, hi. What would you like to bring up about long COVID?
Hi. I had COVID the first time in October of 2020, and then I had it again this January, and I've had insomnia from that time. I've never had a problem sleeping in my life. And I wondered if the link to gut health could be part of that, because I know that you make a lot of, your second biggest brain is in your stomach. I also have the weird taste problems, like right now peanut butter tastes like jalapenos without the spice, which is no fun because I like peanut butter. And I had some hair loss too, but I was wondering if there could be something there because I have tried a lot of stuff and I still don't feel sleepy.
Jenny, thank you so much. And I heard Jenny say your second biggest brain is in your stomach, Dr. Vanishkashorn.
Yes, there has been some growing research indicating that there is a connection between cognition and brain function. symptoms from depression and anxiety and the health of our gut. And so it's a growing body of research out there, but we definitely recommend that individuals who have COVID and maybe having GI symptoms actively try to help promote the health of their gut. And that can be done by things like eating a balanced Mediterranean diet, trying to avoid overly processed foods, with the hope that if we can optimize the normal bacterial growth that occurs in the gut naturally, keep it healthy, this will lead to improvements in the rest of the body, like troubles with sleep, troubled thinking, or mood symptoms.
Have you seen issues in your clinic with insomnia?
Unfortunately, this is a very common symptom. Many people come through COVID experiencing sleep problems. It's easy to see why this happens, right? We are sick, and so naturally many of us try to nap. And we're taking multiple naps during the day during the acute infection, and that really throws off the cycle. And it can be really hard to come back from that. And some people do, but patients with long COVID, they can sometimes have insomnia or sleep disturbance issues that last for several weeks to several months. In fact, treating sleep issues is the first thing that we focus on in our program because it's kind of the lowest hanging fruit to help people with their fatigue.
And I would imagine sleep helps a body recover as well. So once you're able to address those sleep issues, that can also help the body repair, I would imagine.
You got it. Exactly. And people forget that we can feel pretty miserable if we're not sleeping well. And I would say this is probably the fourth most common thing that we see amongst our patients who come to Mayo looking for help with long COVID.
So, you know, in terms of diet and exercise and, trying to do those holistic life things, are there any prescriptions that you also look at, or what really can help solve the insomnia issue that you see with patients?
Yeah, great question. So when it comes to the diet, definitely I recommend avoiding any kind of fad diets. And we've looked at all the kind of research out there, and we do not see any kind of improvement with a specific diet. And so a nice balanced diet is where I would start with. When it comes to activity, I try to avoid using the word exercise with patients who are suffering long COVID, because what we have found is that patients with this condition, if they try to push themselves at all, they tend to have a flare of their symptoms that can last even for hours or days. And these flares, we actually think, cause more inflammation, put the patients back a little bit further and kind of stall them in their recovery. So we actually recommend some gentle, slow-paced activity with slow increases over time. And that is what really allows patients to recover in the appropriate fashion.
Jenny, thank you for the call. Mary now in Viroqua. Mary, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. I'm wondering, right now I'm undergoing a pretty severe chronic case of diarrhea that started at the end of May. And I've been tested for the usual suspects of food poisoning or waterborne. And the best advice I've had so far is to just cut back on a lot of fiber and roughage in my diet. I do eat a lot of fruit and vegetables. I'm pretty particular about my diet. So this came on pretty quickly. I've been vaccinated. I don't think I've had COVID, but I've never been tested. But I'm kind of wondering if this might not be a case of long-haul COVID that's just affecting my digestive system.
Mary, thank you for that question. Dr. Vinish Kishoren, do you have any insights there?
Yeah, no, this is a story that I hear quite a bit, and I'm sorry that you've had these ongoing symptoms, and I hope that you continue to feeling better here. It's important to remember that the symptoms are quite nebulous of long COVID, and sort of the million-dollar question out there is how do you determine if something is long COVID related or something that's related to a separate condition like irritable bowel that we already mentioned. But the important thing to remember is that the treatment right now, based on what we see in science, is going to be the same, whether or not diarrhea is related to long COVID or it's related to irritable bowel or something else. And so I think you've done what I would recommend is visit with your care providers to get some answers, do some diagnostics. But in the end, The treatment is going to be the same. The treatments that we are using right now are fairly basic and conservative, such as a good diet. There's no medicine out there to recommend for a specific treatment of this.
Talking about long COVID impacts on the gut and digestive system with Dr. Greg Vanishkashorn, director of Mayo Clinic's COVID Activity Rehabilitation Program in Rochester, Minnesota. Two studies that came out of this year indicate long haulers are having adverse digestive and GI issues. You can join in with your questions about long COVID, 800-642-1234. Dr. Vanishkashorn, what do researchers know about the effectiveness of the COVID vaccines to reduce the frequency of long COVID? Is there any new analysis there?
There's some new information that has looked at this question. And what we have seen so far is that the vaccine does not prevent individuals from having long COVID. Now, that being said, we are starting to see a little bit of a different symptom presentation between individuals who present vaccinated and have long COVID and those who don't have vaccines or who are not vaccinated and have long COVID. That data needs to be analyzed further here, but it's something that we're looking at very closely. Another thing that we've come to appreciate between the two different groups is that individuals who are vaccinated, they do seem to get better faster with long COVID compared to individuals who are not vaccinated. But again, there's a lot of things that go into that. You know, these individuals that are vaccinated, they also tend to present for care earlier than others. So a lot of factors could be going into this different presentation and different outcome.
Your clinic also helps long COVID patients get back to work and help them, you know, rehabilitate and try to get back to normal life functions. What are some strategies there for people who are dealing with long COVID?
Mm-hmm. I think the first thing that I would recommend is foster communication with your employer. Many individuals, they go through this not wanting to share their situation because they're afraid of stigma and so forth. Their employer needs to know that they're going through these symptoms and that there is treatment that's occurring and that people do get better over time. So that kind of gives both the employee and the employer the ability to plan ahead and know that right now we're going through something unique, but hopefully the person will get back on their job soon. When it comes to interacting with the medical system, I think it's important to also mention difficulties with work or other functional activities to your treating doctors, your medical providers, when you go to seek help. This is an important way to judge function and improvements in function as treatment occurs and really sets a goal for what we're trying to achieve with treatment.
Dr. Vanishkashorn, thank you for joining us.
No problem. It's my pleasure to be here. Happy to foster the conversation.
Dr. Greg Vanishkashorn is director of Mayo Clinic's COVID Activity Rehabilitation Program in Rochester, Minnesota. We have links at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, the Wisconsin Veterans of Foreign Wars, the VFW, is celebrating 100 years. The statewide organization has more than 25,000 members and is looking to its future leaders, a younger generation of veterans. We meet the new state VFW commander and hear what the VFW means to you. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.